It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the past, present, and future of the filibuster in the U.S. Senate amid some calls to get rid of it. First, adulthood can be boring, and our next guest says we should prepare our kids for that. She says we don't always give boredom enough credit. Unfilled space can be constructive, especially when teaching self-discipline, how to think for ourselves, and it can be a boost for creativity. Pamela Paul is the editor of the Book Review and oversees books coverage at the New York Times. She's the author of several books, including her most recent, My Life with Bob, Flawed Heroine Keeps Book of Books, Plot Ensues. She wrote the piece, Let Children Get Bored Again, for the New York Times. Pamela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Are we as a society, and maybe as parents in particular, not ready to let our kids get bored?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about you, but growing up, I was bored all the time. It was boring. It was boring. My afternoons were empty. Television in the afternoon was terrible. This was like back in the days of, you know, having to get up and physically change the channel. And it was like, you know, reruns of Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. There just was not, it was not that good. And that was my problem. Nowadays, boredom, not only is it seen as a problem, but grown-ups are seen as the solution to that problem, which was not the case before. You know, decades ago, if you were bored, that was your problem, and it was your problem to get through and to figure out how to fix it. I feel like that whole idea has gone away.
Yeah, there's a temptation for adults to intervene, and I could see in some cases, I'm a parent and I'm totally guilty of this, in some cases, if you are with kids and doing something, you don't want to live with the consequences of a kid who's very expressively bored out of their minds. Is it okay to step in sometimes then?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have three kids, so I'm very familiar with bored kids, and I think that there is a lot of pressure on parents, and I think that there is this idea, first of all, most people are brought up, they have two working parents, and so the parents have very little time with their kids, and the time that you have, you want to kind of, you know, it's that quality time thing over quantity time, although there's the constant debate about which is actually the more important. But when you don't have a lot of time with your kids, you want it to be kind of intentional. You want to be able to figure out, like, what is the best way thing that we could do with this 1 hour that we have together. And so there's not the same kind of leisure of having, say, 4 hours with your child where you'd be perfectly content to kind of have them, you know, left to their own devices. I also think that, you know, parenting in general has become incredibly competitive, and there's this idea from a very young age that our children are sort of on a race to compete in this, like, ruthless game of life, and especially economically. So there's an idea, there's a kind of implicit understanding that if you want your child to be, quote-unquote, competitive, that you have to do something with their extra time, that their time shouldn't be, quote-unquote, wasted. It's as if we're constantly sort of putting money in the bank of our kids in the hopes that in the future they will then be equipped with everything they can have to succeed. And I think what's gotten lost there is that one of those things that actually will help them succeed, and again, I have a little bit of problem even with that term, but succeed, and I mean be fulfilled and be happy, is learning to cope with boredom.
Talk about the positives that come out of dealing with boredom for a kid.
Well, so when you are bored, right, when you are staring out the window in the backseat of the car, which I feel like nobody has to do anymore, and nobody ever really, like, puts on music that the kids hate anymore in the car that they have to suffer through. When you are staring out that window, your brain wanders. You have empty time. That's when your imagination sort of takes hold. That's where, even if you're staring at the most sort of semi-featureless stretch of highway, you begin to notice little things. You look up at the clouds. You see the trees. You notice the birds. You might notice something interesting about license plates that you've never noticed before. But you are sort of forced by that tedium into finding the interesting thing, either that's out there or that's internal, that's in your head. And we don't have to do that anymore. So it's like when we talk about one of the qualities that we want our children to have, resourcefulness, that's where you have to be resourceful because you literally have kind of nothing to play with necessarily, and you're forced to come up with that you know, sort of scenario that saves you from boredom.
Talking to Pamela Paul from the New York Times, she wrote recently about the value of boredom for kids and how the grown-ups, are maybe overfilling our kids' time with entertainment or productive activities. Pamela, as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I see this with the kids. I kind of see this with me, too. There are many quickly available ways for me to fill my time that, yeah, why would I spend a second being bored? I'll play a game on the phone. I'll pick up a book. I'll listen to an audio, whatever. Are we adults hurting ourselves, too?
Oh, we definitely are. I mean, it's funny, when I first wrote this piece and when I was thinking about it, I really thought this is not just for us kids, it's for us adults. And one of the reasons, one of the sort of the triggers for me writing this piece, there were a few things. One of them was, I, like probably many other people, have thought to myself for the last 10 years, I should really learn how to meditate. Everyone who meditates is, you know, peaceful, more well-balanced, sleeps better at night, all these wonderful things. And so I did a little bit of research. We have this great guide online at the Times, like your guide to meditation. I read that. There was a column about meditating, and I thought, I really need to get down to it. I downloaded a few apps. I have a little reminder that pops up. I have yet to meditate. And I thought, why is it like that I need to fill up that little empty time that I have, and that frankly I don't even have, with something that is very intentional? I thought, why is it that we need to fill up that empty space? Like, what is it that, you know, it's like boredom isn't just a low cost version of meditation. In a certain way, it's actually very much the opposite, right? Because with meditation, you're supposed to like let go of those thoughts that enter into your mind. With boredom, you're doing the opposite. You're grabbing onto them. And I thought, like, that's actually what I really need to do, in a way, is instead of using my time on my commute to, you know, catch up on reading and doing and listening and everything that we all need to do all the time, actually what I should be doing is just looking out the window.
Have you in your life, can you point toward times when you've gotten good creative inspiration out of your boredom?
Yeah. I mean, I think two of the most boring things to me are falling asleep and taking a shower, right? And they're things that are inescapable. There's nothing you can do. I guess people put like radios in their showers or whatever. I've never gotten that creative. And it is not surprising that then the best ideas happen when I'm in the shower or when I'm falling asleep. I actually now keep a notepad with a pen by my bed at night, because when my brain is sort of freely wandering, even though I suppose, you know, I should be actually falling asleep, but during that boring, you know, trajectory into sleep, my brain starts to come up with ideas. And I'm often thinking, if I'm working on a writing project, that's when I'm thinking of things, or when I'm in the shower. So I often do find myself, you know, dashing out of the shower to try to go and write something down.
There seems to be this move toward optimizing our time lately. And this, I think, is true for our kids and for ourselves. So you're not just doing one thing. You're listening and learning Spanish while you shower, or, you know, listening to a book while you cook or whatever. Is that part of what's driving us away from having slack boredom time?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that urge to multitask, that sort of constant drive to up the ante, I think it's very dangerous. I mean, one of the other sort of inspirations for this piece was back to school night. So you go to back to school night, right? And all the teachers are talking about is trying to engage the children, trying to capture their attention, trying to, you know, get them to be excited. And they find it really hard. And I think to myself, you know what? When I was a kid, the teachers really weren't all that concerned about how bored we were or how inspired we were. They knew that sometimes information that you need to learn is not necessarily exciting, and that, in fact, that's part of the lesson, right? Part of the lesson that you are learning in school is not because you need to know the quadratic equation. It's because you need to tolerate the fact that you need to know the quadratic equation, right? It's the fact that you do not find something terribly exciting, and yet you need to learn it or put up with it in some way anyhow. So I think to myself, as I'm going to that back-to-school night, I'm thinking, I don't really want all this stuff to be that fun and exciting and engaging for my kids. In fact, I kind of would rather it be a little bit boring. Don't tell my kids. I hope they're not listening. But it's true. I think that part of what they need to learn is that acquiring information isn't always necessarily fun. That doesn't make it any less worthwhile or less important.
We're talking to Pamela Paul from the New York Times about boredom and its potential benefits. She wrote a piece headlined "Let Children Get Bored Again" for the opinion section there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of boredom? Do you think we try to overfill our kids' time with productive activities, entertainment, you name it? Can you point toward a time in your life where you were glad you were kind of bored? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Pamela Paul is with us from the New York Times. She's the editor of the book review section there. We're talking with her about the benefits of boredom for kids, and she says we don't let our kids be bored enough. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think boredom can be useful? Does it teach us lessons? Do you look back on boring time as a kid fondly, or do you wish there'd been a smartphone to fill that time? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Teresa is with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hi. I have two comments to make, actually, and obviously I wasn't born in this country, but the first comment is, I'm not sure whether this lady had or woman has studied education and how children learn, but I can assure you that if you sit a child in a class and they're bored stiff, they don't learn. What she's talking about, I think, is developing in children the understanding that not everything you do may be fun, but if you bore the hell out of kids, they'll just shut off. So I think she's totally wrong there. And if any teacher is listening, I hope they'll respond. But secondly, when I first came to this country in 93, I had two children. And I used to go to cooperative playgroups so I could talk to mums, American mums. And I was astonished the first Monday I went in when someone told me what they'd done. And that included an early breakfast, hit the market, then go for brunch, then go for something at the community centre, then go bowling, and then maybe we'll talk to each other. There's this incessant need in this country to be doing things as if you're not doing things, you're not using your brain. You know what the British do? They sit on the sofa and look at each other.
Teresa, thanks a lot for the call. Pamela, she half agrees, half disagrees with you. Let's take the disagree half. She says we can't allow too much boredom in schools. Kids aren't going to engage and learn then.
Well, you know, I have taught, and I've talked to a lot of teachers, and I've also talked to a lot of college professors who I think are getting the kind of brunt of this sort of upping the ante in terms of edutainment and a kind of increase in this entertaining form of education, because they find that by the time kids get to college, they are not willing to endure to sit through lectures, that it's sort of on them to entertain the kids, otherwise they're going to just go online, look at their laptop, sort of do something else. And I think that's because they haven't been properly trained to pay attention to information that might not necessarily be that fun. The other thing that I find is interesting that's changed a lot in the classroom is that there is a lot more use of screens, of websites, of quote-unquote, you know, edutainment or educational games, which, let's face it, are frankly video games and not necessarily educational. They may be entertaining. And also a lot more use of films in the classroom for history, for example, you know, rather than have a conversation or do some kind of lesson around the Civil War, the kids might end up watching Glory, for example. Well, you know what? They can watch Glory on their own free time. It's a great movie. I'm not saying anything against it. But to replace a lesson on that with a film then means the next time you try to do a lesson, that's not nearly as fun or entertaining as it was watching a major Hollywood movie.
And Teresa, on the other hand, saying she sees Americans in general, maybe young and old, wanting to fill our time up way too much. We should adopt the British system of sitting and staring on the couch. That is a little closer to what you're talking about, I think, Pamela.
That I like, yeah. I mean, you know what? Just have conversation. And just learn to make conversation. Like, that's a skill. And if you're not sort of forced and trained to do that, you don't develop it. I mean, there's all this discussion now of, like, kids not knowing how to you know, court one another off of a device, that all of it takes place in some way, shape, or form on a phone. That's kind of scary.
We also asked on Facebook whether people think we overschedule our kids or whether we allow boredom time. We heard from Gabe, who says only boring people get bored. And I think that's kind of a commonplace statement, Pamela. What do you think of that idea?
Well, yes. I mean, that was what we were told growing up. But I think that what the underlying meaning of that is that if you are bored, you have to learn how to do something about it. And that is what, you know, that is what you are forced to do when you need to endure boredom. But if you get rid of that training, right, then you don't learn that. Then I think actually paradoxically you do kind of become a boring person because you need to be entertained all the time. You don't have the inner resources to be able to handle it if you're constantly being, you know, having the problem solved for you.
We're talking to Pamela Paul from the New York Times about a piece she wrote on kids and boredom. She says we don't let kids have enough boredom, and that's getting in the way of their creativity, their independence. Back to your calls now. Caitlin is with us in La Crosse. Caitlin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Caitlin?
So it was the piece about how teachers are trying to engage the students at every moment and trying to make the information exciting. And I see the point both ways, but I think that the hardest part for me to grasp is that her argument is that the students should, like, take a lesson out of learning that they might have to learn this monotonous information, even though it's not fun for them. And although that might work, if you have a parent who's at home saying, no, this is important, and reinforcing that, a lot of kids in schools don't have parents who are at home teaching them these same lessons and making learning important. So I think that's where the teachers really have to try and make the information engaging so that the students who don't have that reinforcement at home want to learn it.
Caitlin,
and that's where I think the disconnect is.
Caitlin, thanks for the call. Pamela, she says, yeah, teachers are in some ways trying to make up for what kids come in from home with.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, again, I don't know what your experience was like growing up, but when I was growing up, there was sort of no idea of, there was no concept of parent involvement. My parents never taught anything. That was the school's job. You know, they never reinforced any lessons. And what you learned in school was, on occasion, very boring. So, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I would say that it's very hard for a teacher to compete. If the parent at home is allowing the child to be constantly entertained, and then the parent, then they go to school, and by contrast, the teacher is the first one that's introducing this concept of, you know, not everything is fun all the time, I do think it's a really uphill battle. So it really is about the kind of, this needs to change on both fronts, because what you're doing is, if you're constantly upping the ante for entertainment in one sphere, then it's necessarily going to put a burden on the other sphere. So if it's happening at school but not at home, then it puts pressure on home and vice versa.
Thanks for the call, Caitlin. We heard from Karen on Facebook, who says, when my kids said they were bored, I'd say you wouldn't know excitement if you didn't know boredom. What do you think of that idea, Pamela?
Oh, I totally agree. You know, it's the same thing with art. You know, if you don't read a bad book or look at a painting that isn't great or see terrible theater or a dull movie, then you're not going to know what, you know, what a really good work of art is.
Now, I wonder, Pamela, is the barn door open and has been open too long? Is there any way to turn this back around and start to reclaim boredom?
I mean, absolutely. Look, most people, most adults, right, they're the ones in charge. It's up to the schools, to the teachers, to the parents. I'm surprised that, you know, parents give children as much access to digital devices as they do. Look, it's up to the parent. They could take it away. They don't have to give them a phone or a tablet or access to watch TV endlessly in the first place. That's the rule of the house. So if you deprive the child of these kind of very easy forms of entertainment, they're going to be the ones that have to come up with something on their own. And I also think, you know, and it's very hard. Look, I mean, I see this as a parent as well, but you have to be able to let go of, you know, the temptation to intervene yourself. So just because you're saying, oh, you can't play with the iPad in the afternoon, doesn't mean then that it's on the parent to swoop in and be like, and let's play this game instead. Sometimes you can just say, you know what, you have a room full of toys, a room full of books, figure it out.
All right, that's for the kids. Have you been able to put this into practice yourself and open up? You mentioned your non-experiment with meditation earlier. Have you, reinvented the staring on the couch time again or something like that?
I don't know that I've reinvented the staring on the couch, but for me, what I think can be challenging is to find, you were talking earlier about multitasking, is to really cancel out all the other noise so that I can sit and read something that might not be on the surface entertaining, and it might not be a fast-moving plot, and it might be a 1,000-page book, but to just sit there and to allow myself the time and the space to sink into it and to, give it time to develop. Like, there are some great novels that take 100 pages to get off the ground that, people used to be more patient and accustomed to a long Victorian novel that took some time to develop, and then you're sucked in. But for me, it's allowing the space and the attention to devote to that. But, I'm a book person.
Is this an attention span issue, too? Do you think a lack of boredom is making us flit from one thing to another more quickly?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's interesting. If you compare video games from the 70s, like you went to the arcade, right, and there was Asteroids. Okay, Asteroids, I don't know if you remember that, or Space Invaders.
Oh, yeah.
One of those very early arcade games, right? They were black and white. They were very simple pixelated lines. There was like two different functions you could have. There were very little rewards, right? And it was really hard. And you compare that to your average video game today, in which there's constantly bells and whistles and noise going off, and also you're constantly rewarded. It's like it's much easier to get the points. If you have a child that's grown up in that new video game arena, and you ask them to go back to something like Asteroids, it's incredibly frustrating, it's incredibly boring, it's really hard, and it's not that fun. Which is interesting, right? Because we've upped the ante. We've upped the expectation of what that kind of fun, immersive experience is.
Pamela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Pamela Paul, editor of the Book Review at the New York Times. She's the author of several books, including her most recent, My Life with Bob. She joined us to talk about a piece she wrote in the Times called Let Children Get Bored Again. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, should the filibuster stay or should it go? We'll talk to a political scientist about the history of this political procedure, its role in dysfunction in the U.S. Senate, and what reforms could look like. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We take a look at the political procedures of the U.S. Senate. One thing unique to that body is the filibuster, a tactic to slow or even stop debate. But not everybody's a fan of the filibuster. Some 2020 Democratic presidential candidates are talking about whether to get rid of it altogether. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and professor of political science at George Washington University. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, briefly remind us, what does filibustering allow senators to do?
So a filibuster is really extended debate, right? It means that a Senate majority can't just vote to cut off debate, right? And that means small groups of senators, 40 senators, right? Small groups of senators can block a majority of the Senate from pushing ahead on its agenda. It can change the topics. It can talk about things unrelated. It can grind the Senate to a halt. It can hold a measure hostage until it gets its way on a different measure. But the filibuster empowers both individual senators and then small factions of senators within the broader chamber.
And this isn't something that's in the Constitution, right? This came about as a Senate rule. Do I have that right?
So the Constitution was very clear. It said that the House and Senate can write their own rules. And at the beginning, back in 1789, House and Senate had a pretty similar rule book. And then some historical things happened. We can talk about if we want. But essentially, the Senate got rid of the one rule that today the House uses to allow a majority to cut off debate. And once that rule is dropped from the rule book, right, senators realize there is no rule that somebody can call to cut off debate, and that allows senators to talk right until everybody's ready, right? Everybody has to decide. Otherwise, a single senator could still hold the floor and keep talking.
I got to ask about the name, because I'm really curious about this. I know at one point a filibuster in American history was somebody who went to a foreign country, usually part of the Spanish Empire, tried to start a rebellion and get them to join the United States. How did a filibuster go from that to this?
A little murky. We think sometime in the 19th century, a senator or two, when the term of these filibusterers in across Latin America was more common, that somebody applied it to the Senate because one senator was essentially sort of rough riding over the interests and the rights of the other senators.
Now, what is the effect of the filibuster on the way legislation happens? Some people have said this is good. It moderates things. It keeps one party from running roughshod over the other. Other people say it just bogs things down. What do you see as the impact?
So one thing to keep in mind is this. If we lived in a world today where the two parties really weren't that far apart, right? And so if in today's rules in the Senate, the way you cut off a debate, the way you kill a filibuster, is we use a rule called cloture. And that means you need 60 senators to agree. So if, let's say, the Democrats had 52 seats, and let's say the Republicans had 48, but they really weren't very far apart, they didn't really disagree all that much, it wasn't that partisan, then what you'd have to do to change a bill to get the vote of 60 senators, it probably would moderate legislation, right? Instead of suspending, say, $200 million on national parks, maybe we'd moderate it because a Republican would disagree. Maybe we'd moderate it made to $180 million. But that's not the Senate we live in today, right? We live in a Senate where the two parties are pretty far apart on all sorts of issues, right? And then what do you have to do to change a bill to get 60 senators to agree? Well, some people would say maybe that's not really moderating legislation. And maybe sometimes the minority filibusters because they don't want any legislation. And then you have to wonder, well, but is the filibuster really a force for good, or does it do more harm over time?
And when we think of filibusters, we might think of the dramatic moment we heard in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where somebody has to get there and they have to actually physically be there and keep talking the whole time. That isn't really how you can just kind of like threaten the filibuster, basically. Is that right?
Yeah. And over, I would say, the last several decades, once the Senate put in place the 60-vote rule and they sort of nailed that down in 1975, it just became easier as the workloads got larger and people wanted to be out. Senators want to raise money. They're traveling. They're back home. Nobody really wants to spend their time on the floor overnight. And so it's just easier to threaten. And leaders will hear those threats and they'll say, okay, we'll just move on to something else, which, of course, just right encourages all the other senators to threaten the filibuster, knowing they're not going to have to show up and talk all night.
Talking to Sarah Binder from the Brookings Institution and George Washington University, looking at the past, present, and future of the U.S. Senate's filibuster. Sarah, we've seen some erosion lately in the filibuster when it comes to appointing judicial candidates. Supreme Court justices, for example, has been on the table as a big possible change. What have you seen lately?
So starting in it was 2013, when the Democrats were in control of the Senate, frustration with Republican tactics blocking President Obama's nominees convinced Democrats to do what we call nuke the filibuster, or nuke the cloture rule, that 60-vote rule. So, and we can, the dynamics here get a little in the weeds about how Senate procedure works, but essentially a majority of the Senate reinterpreted the rule. They said instead of needing 60 votes to cut off debate on a nomination, we're just going to require a simple majority. And Republicans didn't take it very well, as you might expect, because they're used to being able to block nominations. But what goes around comes around in the Senate, and when Republicans regained control of the Senate in 2017, and they had an opening, of course, from Justice Scalia's seat that had never been filled back in 2016, Republicans, in order to confirm Trump's nominee, Neil Gorsuch, they nuked the rest of the nomination's filibusters, meaning you could no longer filibuster a Supreme Court nomination.
There's been talk among some Democratic progressive advocates that, hey, if the Democrats retake the Senate, say, in the next election, they should get rid of the filibuster altogether. Is that something you think either party would want to do?
So I think there's a lot of debate about it, and I think there's lots of disagreements even within the Democrats and even within sort of progressive Democrats who are announced or going to announce for president. The issue here really is, over the long term, plus over the future, does one party or the other benefit more from moving to a system of majority rule in the Senate? And many people would argue that Democrats have more to gain, right? That because they see using the tools of government and have kind of a pretty ambitious policy agenda of problems they want to fix, many people would argue that the only way for Democrats to really achieve those big goals, climate change, immigration reform, energy, transportation, civil rights, voting rights, the only way to get there would be to nuke the filibuster, right, so that a simple majority of the Senate could push its agenda through the Senate. Now, of course, the filibuster is pretty valuable to the Democrats when they're in the minority, as I think it's been driven home to them during the Trump administration. So I think it gives some senators cold feet, right? Thinking about the long term, do we benefit? Yes, we would. But would we want to see the Trump agenda pushed through by a Republican Congress? Maybe not. And so I think that's why you're seeing some mixed degrees of views about whether or not the filibuster should be kept or whether its time has come and gone.
When we talk about Congress in general, the word dysfunction comes up quite a bit with the partisan differences. Do you see a structural fix, tweaking the rules of the way the Senate and or the House work, as being something that could overcome that? Or is this dysfunction and this division coming from outside the chambers?
So it's really a bit of both. These are very polarized parties and very partisan parties, meaning that my team's for it, so your team's against it, even if it's not an ideological difference between the parties. And those types of differences, they make compromise hard, and they make constructing deals hard, right? Deals where both sides get something out of the policy. And so the rules complicated for sure, but the rules themselves, right? If we could change the rules overnight, it doesn't mean that those divisions are going to go away. And so, yes, Congress is struggling to legislate. It's been that way for 10 plus, if not 20 years. The rules make it even harder, particularly in the Senate. But sometimes lawmakers like to blame the rules, right? To say, well, don't put the blame on us, right? It's the other party, and we're doing whatever we can under the rules. And so I think there's some degree of deep down in many senators where they might actually like a system where they can blame the other party rather than having to come up with compromises within their own party to push ahead.
Now, people have been complaining about Congress since, I think, just before there was a Congress. Is this partly working as designed? Was the idea that, okay, we don't want an institution that can do radical changes really fast?
Well, scholars disagree about what the framers really wanted. My own view is if we look at the Constitutional Convention, if we look at the what we call the Articles of Confederation, right, what was in place before we got our current Constitution, the framers, whether it was Hamilton, whether it was Madison, they expressed a lot of frustration with that earlier Congress because of its supermajority rules, right? These framers had lived in a world where nothing much got done, and part of the impetus on designing the new Constitution was to overcome some of those problems to make a more energetic government that could actually do stuff. So, yes, it's a system that's slow, that divides parties, divides power between the branches, within the branch. And so we don't want to overestimate framers' enthusiasm for an active government. But neither do I think we want to just assume that they'd be happy with living in a world where not much ever got done.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Bender is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and professor of political science at George Washington University. She was with us to talk about the history of the filibuster in the Senate amid news that some Senate Democrats are thinking about getting rid of it if they enter the majority. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind about the coming government shutdown deadline and get his reaction to President Trump's State of the Union address. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we check in with a member of Wisconsin's congressional delegation to hear about what's happening on Capitol Hill amid a deadline to fund President Trump's border wall and head off another government shutdown and get a reaction to the State of the Union address. Representative Ron Kind is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district, which includes La Crosse. Representative Kind, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start with the president's State of the Union address earlier this week. Your reactions to at least some of what the president had to say.
Well, he started out strong. He talked about the need for greater unity, to offer an agenda that is not Republican, not Democrat, but one for the American people. We do need more bipartisan support. Things have gotten way too polarized. He also highlighted a few issues where there is some common ground, whether it's rebuilding Wisconsin, America, with an infrastructure plan, being able to eliminate HIV/AIDS within the next 10 years, increase funding for early childhood cancer cures, and trying to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, making that more affordable. There's a lot of bipartisan interest in taking those issues on. And I would hope that working with Congress, the administration will focus on things that do, in fact, unite us rather than just pushing buttons that further divide us.
Okay, that said, there's still the risk of another shutdown over border security and wall funding. That's been the dividing issue in the last couple of months in Washington. What do you see coming out of that?
Well, it was interesting. It was almost like the dog that didn't bark at the State of the Union that was interesting. The fact that he did not draw a red line, he did not make that a point of emphasis at the State of the Union, that he was going to shut the government down again if he didn't get all his funding for a border wall. And so it tells me he may not want to fall into this trap again without a plan B and how to get out. And I can guarantee you there's no stomach for another shutdown in the halls of Congress. If it does happen, it will be because of one individual, the president, and what he decides to do. But I think, you know, reasonable people can reach agreement on what's necessary to further secure the southern border. I'd like to do it with 21st century technology, which will be more effective and less costly, rather than a C2C wall that he's proposing. And there are other measures we got to fix with immigration, from those who are overstaying their valid visas, from drug interdiction coming into our ports of entry, to making sure that we have a plausible plan to deal with 11 million undocumented people who are here already, many of whom working jobs in America. And we just saw this past week where the Trump Organization and a lot of his resorts were firing people who are undocumented, who actually have been working for them for years and years. So there are areas, I think, of bipartisan common agreement on how to fix the broken immigration system. We just need the political will to do it and stop politicizing this issue all the time.
Are House Democrats allergic to the idea at this point of any kind of wall, not a coast-to-coast wall, but, you know, structures in place, barriers in place? Can you vote for something that includes some sort of walls?
Yeah, you know, the short answer is yes. I'm not going to speak for all my colleagues, but, you know, realistically, there may be certain high traffic areas that it makes sense to add some additional fencing or some type of barrier. But in doing that, I want it fact-based. I want it evident-based. I want it driven by local officials who are going to know best. I think it would make sense making sure that those border governors sign off on any plan. But also remember, Rob, we've already invested billions of dollars on structures on the southern border along the high traffic areas. It's one of the reasons why illegal crossings is at a 50-year low right now. In fact, for a while there were more people leaving the United States across the southern border than coming into the United States. But again, the president's not emphasizing that. In fact, he's creating this fear-mongering atmosphere out there that somehow there's this emergency crisis that is non-existent along the southern border in order to fulfill a campaign pledge. But to say completely that, no, all the structures there is enough, I think ignores the reality on the ground, but it should be fact-based and driven by the local officials themselves.
Talking to Wisconsin Congressional Representative Ron Kind about some of the big issues in the nation's capital. You have participated in writing some bipartisan legislation on the issue of tariffs and exerting more congressional authority when it comes to tariffs over national security reasons, something like President Trump has done, for example, with steel and aluminum. What are you hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, you know, just this past week, my good friend and colleague from Green Bay, Mike Gallagher, and I introduced a bill that would address the 232 steel and aluminum tariffs by giving Congress a more meaningful role and say in the imposition of these tariffs. The president has said he's addicted to tariffs. He likes the fact that he can wake up one morning, click his fingers, and start imposing tariffs on any country, friend or foe alike, under the guise of national security concerns, with no say at all from Congress and therefore the American people. And yet it's clear in the Constitution under Article 1 that delegates trade authority to Congress. So our bill is a reflection of the Constitution. It says, Congress, you got a role and voice to play when it comes to the imposition of tariffs, and that's what our bill exactly requires. It gives Congress a chance to repeal or block the imposition of tariffs if we think it's not right what the president is doing. I've not been a big fan of his tariffs that he's imposed. It's doing incredible amount of damage to our manufacturers and farmers in particular in Wisconsin. And I think the president fails to realize that a tariff is a tax on the American consumer. It's the consumer who ultimately pays for the tariff, not the other country that he's trying to punish. And that has an adverse economic impact on our economy. So I'd like to hopefully move forward in a bipartisan way with the legislation that we propose. We have a companion bill over in the U.S. Senate, and there is growing bipartisan interest of asserting Congress's role back in trade policy, and in particular, in this instance, dealing with the tariffs that the president has become addicted with.
Are you hearing concerns from your constituents about the impact of back-and-forth tariffs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Every day I'm out visiting factories. I'm visiting family farmers. They're getting pounded right now. I'm really worried about the state of our family farmers in Wisconsin and throughout our country. I've never seen it this bad, Rob. I mean, the commodity prices have been low for a number of years already. These tariffs now is like piling on because we're losing export market share the longer these tariffs continue, which means we can't clear the excess surplus of commodities that we produce in the country, and therefore the price keeps going down more and more, driving more of our farmers into bankruptcy. And once you start losing, you know, this market share, it's awfully hard to get it back. You know, Mexico is the classic example. The president imposed steel and aluminum tariffs against Mexico. Mexico retaliated, as everyone expected them to, and now our number one dairy export market, Mexico, has been taken away. And that excess surplus is staying home, driving prices down even more. So there are consequences to what the president's doing. It's not just a one-way street when it comes to imposing tariffs. Other countries have the ability to inflict some harm on us, and they're certainly doing that right now. And I think it's especially acute in the upper Midwest and what we're seeing.
In the State of the Union address, President Trump warned against the impact of investigations on his administration and on the economy. Ultimately, he's talking about the Mueller probe there, but he's also talking about a Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. What are you hoping to see, you and your Democratic colleagues, when it comes to investigation of the Trump campaign, the Trump administration, and maybe the Trump organization?
Well, first of all, neither party should be engaged in political gotcha investigations. And I was astounded to see the number of committees doing some form of investigation against the Clinton White House during the 1990s, which ultimately led to the impeachment proceedings in that. But Congress does, however, is a co-equal branch with a constitutional obligation to conduct oversight and to ask questions and to look into perhaps malfeasance or wrongdoings being done with the executive branch. And therefore, I think we need to be careful in what areas we are going to investigate. As a former special prosecutor, I like to see some probable cause before you start intruding in this area. And yet, I think there are some very important questions that need answers to, such as, is the president in the back pocket of certain foreign interests? And that's why certain policy decisions are being influenced, or why he's not as critical as he should be with someone like Vladimir Putin, for instance. So I think we owe it to the American people to make sure that the President of the United States is working first and only for the American people and not for some foreign interest.
We'll leave it there for now. Congressman Kind, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Representative Ron Kind is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which includes La Crosse. He joins us today to talk about the State of the Union, the deadline for another government shutdown, and tariffs that are impacting Wisconsin's trade. We and the Morning Show have been inviting members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation onto both of our shows to talk about a lot of the big issues in the nation's capital. You can share your reactions to what they had to say and, of course, listen to those archived interviews over at WPR.org. Yesterday, we took your calls and suggestions about TV ads that drive you nuts. Here's some more we didn't get to. People shared on social media. We heard from Lena. Lena says, I can't stand the Twix commercial. They make it sound like it is very crunchy when it is not. I think that's fair. I mean, it's a candy bar that I do enjoy, or a pair of candy bars, but it isn't really all that crunchy. Lena goes on, I also don't like the ad for acid reflux with the fighting pizza or giant meatball. I've seen that one. Yeah, I agree with you there. Gabe says, a Chevy goatee moron accosting strangers and asking them whether they know Chevy won an award no one's heard of. That one bugs me in part because if you watch sporting events, as I sometimes do, you see those ads again and again and again. Our producer, Jenny Peek, says, really any of the Geico commercials that have the stupid pig. We have a listen to this one here.
Could switching to Geico really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Did the little piggy cry wee, wee, wee all the way home?
Wee! Wee, wee, wee!
Jenny says it's so grating, instant mute status. We're muting in here, don't worry. Finally, Leslie says, nail fungus, germs, pimples, Skittles pox, medical, dental, teeth, adult diapers, pepperoni, cheese thing. I think those are all separate commercials. That's not one item. I don't want to know what it is if it is. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.